Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport. Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, and we continue to catch up on the big storylines of the summer, this time joined by James Papura, head coach at VMI and a member of the NCAA Men's Lacrosse Rules Committee. As the Playing Rules Oversight Panel gets set to decide on Wednesday, July 19th, whether the proposal put forward by the committee in early June will be adopted and move forward, or if there are going to be other revisions. Coach Papura, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
So as we dive into the conversation, we're going to talk a little bit about the process and the product. But before we get there, I want to make sure that the audience has a sense of who they're hearing from. So tell us a little bit about yourself in terms of where you're from, how you got into coaching, and how you ended up at VMI.
Yeah, no doubt. So originally an upstate New York guy, grew up in Rochester, New York, 5'8" guy from Pittsford. Played for Andy Whipple. I always tell people I was kind of a failed hockey experiment, and I was born about an hour south of where I needed to be, up in Canada. And lacrosse was kind of a secondary sport, and ended up picking it up a little bit later than maybe most, and was fortunate enough to start my playing career at Mount St. Mary's in Emmitsburg, Maryland, and ended up transferring to SUNY Geneseo, where I graduated from, and caught the coaching bug, started there, coached at SUNY Brockport was my first job. Was really interesting opportunity to get, as a young 22, 23-year-old, get your feet wet and get into the profession. Moved on to Frostburg State. Got to work with Tommy Pierce and had a great experience there. We were a fifth-year program and made it to the top 20 for the first time in their program history. And wanted to get into the scholarship game. Got an opportunity to go down and work for Jim Fritz down in Charlotte, North Carolina at Queens University of Charlotte. And we had a pretty successful year in being in the top 20 there. Got the opportunity that summer to go to VMI as the offensive coordinator and work with John Bersner, and good experience there as well. Spent 2.5 years there, ultimately left to take my first head coaching job at a Division III school, Arcadia University, just outside of Philadelphia. And when the VMI job had opened up, it was something I always kind of thought about. I had a lot of people reach out to me about the opportunity, and the more and more I learned, the more excitement I got. And I think there's so much potential here to kind of, I've always been attracted to kind of teams that were either younger in their infancy as a program, or maybe needed to, turn around and make them better. So I thought the opportunity here, to the alumni, they're passionate, they're supportive, and they desperately want a winner. And I felt like we could make the product better. So we're surrounded every day by great people. It's enjoyable, and that's where we're at today.
So I'm sure we're going to learn a little bit more about your point of view on the game as the conversation unfolds, and hear a little bit more about what's going on in Lexington. But as far as the actual rules committee is concerned, how did you end up on it? How far into your term are you? And what is the makeup of the group and the dynamic like?
So I had the opportunity last year. I just completed my first of 4 years on the committee, and I was approached about it and asked to be on it and decided to ultimately do it. I think it's important for us as coaches to be involved within the game. I have been on a few different committees in the past, I think, again, the more active we can be as coaches and do our best to help the game, I think that's an important responsibility that we have. Basically, the rules committee is a group of administrators. I believe we've got 4 Division I representatives, a Division II representative, and 3 Division III representatives. And then we've got a couple coaches within that group in addition to those administrators. And so myself and John Tillman are kind of the Division I reps. Alex Smith was our Division II rep. And then our Division III rep was Andrew Fink. So kind of nice to have all 3 divisions represented. Because I think every school, let alone division, brings some unique perspectives into the committee.
No doubt. And in terms of how the conversation unfolds, so you guys met remotely this time, correct?
That is correct.
And it was a handful of 4-hour sessions over the course of 3 or 4 days at the beginning of June?
That's what was penciled in. I think we might have gone a little over on a couple of them, but we were prepared and We did our best to be organized and hit the topics.
So you mentioned the term that we were going to next, which is topics. And I think that one of the important things for people to understand is that, and this is a reflection, I believe, of meeting remotely as opposed to meeting in person in Indianapolis or anywhere else. This is an off-year cycle. And so the rules work on a two-year cycle, essentially on and off year. And in off years, the things that are supposed to be addressed are supposed to be relatively minor or administrative, kind of correcting something that was decided upon the prior year and you know, this unintended consequence arose, or correcting an oversight, filling in a gap, so to speak. So with that as kind of the structure for the conversation, how do you guys, or how do you explain what you guys discussed?
Yeah, so the prop gives us opportunities. It is an off year, as you alluded to. And so obviously with health and safety and integrity of the game, which kind of gives you a catch-all to certain issues, we're able to make some changes, but then certain ones that obviously, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about later are obviously going to be more in the rule change year. So we were organized. We had to prepare. Our materials were sent out prior to Memorial Day weekend. And obviously we met in I want to say early June and kind of started going through. And I think during the year we kind of get feedback from people or things that come up. They collect the materials and then we kind of go over it when people present.
Oftentimes the rules meeting is a function of whatever the big topic of that year was. And I remember there was one really high profile play where I believe it was North Carolina at Johns Hopkins, and Joey Sankey got his defender hung up and then basically stood there for like, you know, 38 seconds or something like that. And that became, you know, a little bit of like a, and this is when we were, you know, in the incremental process towards instituting the shot clock, and went from, you know, essentially nothing in 2011 to the timer on for either the 2012 or 13 season, and then, you know, continue to march toward what ultimately became the fixed 80 second possession clock for the 2019 season. And, you know, there have been similar types of, I don't want to say like incremental, it's been more kind of like fit starts, tweaks to the faceoff X. That's been a big, you know, point of focus for the committee for 15 years. I felt in mid-May, I felt like there really wasn't a big kind of thing that folks were really focused on. The mechanic around the faceoff was a hot topic early in the season, and it felt like maybe that got a little bit smoothed out as the year went along. The 2 and 3 minute non-releasable penalties for hits to the head and neck. I think that the consensus among your peers that I gleaned was, I wish they were more consistently applied or called, but generally speaking, I don't think they've been onerous or wrong or shifted the outcomes of games. And then, you know, I have felt like there was always a potential for a conversation around these 70-yard possession shots against the 10-man ride, but they're was almost no interest in that among college coaches that I spoke to toward the end of April and into May. And what I'm saying is that, like, felt like you guys had like a relatively calm, normal, like uneventful meeting scheduled. And then the Duke Penn State game unfolded. And I think it probably changed a little bit of what the agenda might've been like. So how do you describe what the conversation was like among the committee before Memorial Day and how it unfolded afterward?
Yeah, you know, certainly, obviously, I knew we'd talk about that specific instance, but I think you're right, Terry. I think that for the most part, you know, there's always going to be people that have their opinions on what we can do to be better, but I think just like coaches and a lot of people that are trying to learn every day or become a better version of themselves, I think we all, as part of the committee, have a moral responsibility of what can we do to make sure the game of lacrosse is at its best. And I think we are at a great point in our sports history that we are producing an exciting product that is more fan-friendly, that is, especially living down here in Virginia and teaching some of my new neighbors, you know, what lacrosse is, and maybe they have basketball or football background. It's easy to relate with a shot clock and them, whether it's watching college lacrosse or the PLL. We're certainly, it's a very, very exciting product, and hopefully our game continues to grow. I think replay was always going to be something that was going to be discussed candidly well before that incident. I think that once that happened, obviously, you know, it was kind of a visual black eye to the sport, because in the Army game before that, there was an opportunity to replay, and it wasn't because if it went in or whatnot, it was a time scheduled opportunity to look at, which was in the rules. And it's really unfortunate that that one play was kind of a catch-all of things that could possibly happen. You know, obviously the Duke player, you know, threw an inside roll, got under, and at the time the officials, the primary was blocked by a Duke player, so he didn't have a good position, and the other official was looking for fouls on the play, and so nobody really got a great vantage point of being able to see what actually happened. And you know, one of the officials in the call, it was arguably the most famous official of them all right now, and Matty Palum, and you know, he obviously saw it after the game, and I'm sure he knew it was wrong, and he's probably really upset about it. And I think we're asking a lot out of officials to make really hard plays without being able to go back and review. And, well, although it might have been more on an experimental term, maybe could be argued before that incident, after that, I think everybody, we need to modernize and kind of take after other sports and have that availability to review. And ultimately, everybody wants to get the play right. That's what's important. So certainly was a big play. And you know, I think what we've kind of proposed moving forward is hopefully going to address those situations from ever happening again.
So as a member of the rules committee, were you watching the Duke Penn State game live? And if so, what went through your mind when you saw that play? Was it kind of an immediate recognition of, oh, we're going to be talking about this?
I was, and I think, you know, just as a fan of the sport, you're watching it, and you're watching maybe more of the lacrosse aspect. You know, from our vantage point on TV and whatnot, you couldn't tell. And then as soon as they showed the replay, I think everybody knew it. Then it was all over social media and whatnot. So it's tough, but I think, you know, being able to obviously have the replay now and see it where you get to have that look. I mean, I think any coach that had an iPad on them on the sideline and maybe for had 10 seconds to look at it or replay it once would have seen the toe in the line, and, you know, they would have been able to make the proper call.
So let's shift gears to talk a little bit about the product. And by that, what I mean is the decisions that you guys came to, and realizing that, you know, there are limitations for what you're allowed to discuss on the basis of just kind of the sanctity of the committee and the process that you guys unfolded. I do think that it's helpful for the public to understand, especially, and I don't think that this really is the case here, but for contentious decisions, to understand that, you know, we didn't kind of unilaterally and just willy-nilly end up at this conclusion. It's a decision that's made on the basis of a lot of considerations that went into it. And I think that, you know, the release only includes what the decision was. It doesn't include anything about how you ended up there. So I want to just kind of go through some of the elements of what has been proposed and hear from you in terms of representing the committee's point of view on why you felt like this was the best option. So the first is just the fact that there was a choice to allow for a coach's challenge as opposed to leaving review exclusively to the official. And you've seen these systems, you've seen each system in different sports for the last 20 years. What led to the decision to include a coach's challenge?
I think, you know, certainly, I think that's part of the fun of being on a committee is there's a lot of smart people, and you know, there's a lot of, you know, playing devil's advocate, right? Well, what if we do this, then what are the unintended consequences? And again, at the end of the day, we want to do what's best for the sport and make sure that we're getting it right. And so I think kind of, you know, I draw on my hockey background a lot. I watch a lot of the NHL, certainly watch a lot of college football and things in the NFL. A lot of sports have kind of already started setting precedents. And I think we'd be foolish, especially when we have our own pro game like the PLL that is already doing this. You know, we've got great people on our committee that are providing, you know, feedback from the officials and what can make their life better, what can help them get calls more accurate. Because, again, nobody wants to have an unintended consequence or something that's just not right happen. I think coach's challenge was nice because I don't think it will happen very frequently, candidly. But you have that option available that if you want to risk a timeout, if you believe there's an opportunity that the play was wrong, you're going to have an opportunity to challenge that play and see and make sure that it was, you know, gotten right. And there's a consequence. If you get it wrong, you're going to lose a timeout. And I think all of us coaches enjoy having timeouts. And then I think giving it to the officials under 4 minutes, well, kind of the thought process was, well, what happens if you've already used both your timeouts? There's 32 seconds left, and now you have a one-goal game, and that could either win you the game or tie the game. You can't challenge it. So we wanted to certainly give the refs some influence to be able to have that available to get it right, but at the same time, allow coaches to decide, you know, if the official didn't call it on the field because they couldn't see it and you think it went in. We didn't want to have 1,400 challenges or anything like that, but I think you see in some sports you can take a really long time, and that's not the intended consequence at all. Again, I think maybe speaking on personal experience, there might have been one or two plays we challenged all year through a 15-game schedule. So we felt it was necessary to give the coaches some kind of power, and I know we poll a lot of the coaches as well, and the surveys are really helpful. We get a lot of feedback. You asked earlier. I think that's something that we can continue to do a better job, candidly, as a coaching community, although the NCAA does say that lacrosse is one of the higher participation sports. So I'll take that as a positive.
You brought up a lot there, and I want to drill down on a couple of the elements individually. As context, listeners of this podcast know that I fall more or less more on the anti-review end of the spectrum, primarily because so first, I think it disrupts the experience of the fan in too frequently in too strong of a way. You know, I think it's been really, really destructive to soccer because I think that, you know, pretty much every goal that gets scored, the question of whether or not the goal scorer was onside is immediately asked. And that tamps down the celebration of a goal, which in soccer is like the reason to go is to celebrate one of the two goals that's going to get scored on average over the course of the game. And then with respect to basketball, it just extends the ends of games so dramatically. And so, you know, that with that being said, I'm not saying I'm anti-review. I think I'm just anti-review relative to like most people, because I think most people default to the notion of you got to get the call right. And I am respectful to the fact that, you know, it's the coaches and players that are making the sacrifices in order to be in the arena, right? So like their opinion matters and should matter more than the fans. But ultimately, sports, for everything that they are in our culture, are entertainment. And we need to be cognizant of that as well. And then, again, I'm also respectful to the officials who, to your point about the way in which the officials of the NCAA semifinal feel, like, yeah, they definitely were upset that the call was incorrect and would have really liked a tool in order to correct the call. And I say all that to say that on this podcast, after the Army-Penn State game, I said, that is probably the best use of replay I have ever seen, in the sense that it was a bang-bang play. The fact that the officials managed to get the teams back on the sidelines to stop their celebration was in and of itself an impressive officiating thing. You go directly to the monitor. You quickly make the determination. They were fortunate, no doubt, that the camera technology like allowed for a quick determination. And then it's communicated clearly to the participating teams and then eventually to the crowd. And it was perfect. It was like perfectly executed. So I say all that because how the review occurs is going to have a substantial impact in how long it takes, how likely it is to be accurate, meaning that you don't want to go through this extensive delay and then ultimately end up with a call that was still incorrect on the basis of what the video provided, or inconclusive. And so because the variety of video services is so broad, from the highest end of Division One in the NCAA tournament to, you know, the lowest resources or least resource programs in Division Three. And you've been a part of like a lot of these different this variety of athletic department. What do you know about what the plan is in order for officials to be able to review these calls?
Yeah, I think you just hit a lot there too, and that was kind of the point of the coach's challenge is now you're putting it in the ref's hand. What is if a coach wants to challenge something but they don't have the power to do that? What happens if early in a game you're down 3-0 and you want to call a timeout, but the goal was a 50-50 play? Maybe you get it taken down and now it's 2-0 versus 3-0, or if anything, you're going to burn a timeout anyway. So again, we try to think of all the different scenarios, but I completely agree with you, which is why we didn't want it in the ref's hands and only in the last 4 minutes to be able to make sure that the game wasn't decided, but also have the ability to get it right earlier in a game, but not have these 10-minute replays, or I always allude to offsides in hockey. Those can be some really lengthy reviews, and we want it to be concise and get it right. So to the question about what technology, we're basically the proposal is to make the rule permissive in that if you have the technology available and the home team has access, it would be used for those games. Now, the great thing is, as we kind of unveil the new rule, is every team's going to have different things, right? So obviously, if you get to the NCAA tournament, you're going to have 10 different camera angles. There's people on staff there. For a home team on a college game day, if they have a monitor available at the table, an instant replay, teams will be able to utilize that for the review. Now, I think something that was important for, you know, in feedback that I was receiving from other coaches is, you know, we want to grow lacrosse, right? We don't want to punish teams that might not have the budgetary response and say it's mandated like a shot clock. And, you know, for an instant replay, maybe that costs $5,000 to $10,000 a year or something. And the next thing you know, you see programs getting cut because they can't afford that, or it's just another added cost. So I certainly wanted to be conscientious of that, and that's why we decided to go with this route. So if it's available, the home team has access to that and has a monitor. The plan is to utilize that in those games so that refs have that available. And then you'll have up to 30 seconds as a coach to challenge that play on a non-called goal. So that it's also not something lingering for 3 minutes and all of a sudden the ball goes another direction. And that was basically a precedent set by the PLL. And fortunately for us, we're able to kind of dawn on the experiences of what we've already got. And in the PLL, to their credit, I haven't seen a very lengthy review or something eat up a lot of clock in those games to make it fan friendly.
Yeah, no, it's glad to hear, especially the point about a rule that's permissive but not mandatory. And I think that on the surface, a lot of times that might strike a fan's ear oddly. But I think there are a lot of rules that already exist in that situation or in that realm that people don't even realize. And so there is, you know, familiarity with that and realizing, you know, that depending on the availability of certain situations and resources, games unfold one way, and if they aren't available, then they will unfold a different way.
One other thing I would add to that too is a lot of institutions and other sports are already doing this, so it's also not completely new territory to most athletic departments, and I think lacrosse fans should know that.
One of the rules that can be reviewed or judgments that can be reviewed is with respect to the goal mouth. And the goal mouth has been a point of contention since it's been introduced, or since the dive has been reintroduced, first without a goal mouth and then a goal mouth subsequently introduced after that. Was there any conversation about removing it altogether?
Well, I think if you talk about goal mouths, face-offs, crease play, we could talk for 5 hours on this podcast and maybe get off one topic. Being that it's not technically a rules change year, that was not something that, you know, candidly we can go over. Will it be something that, you know, is discussed next year in a rule change year? And I'm sure it will certainly be a topic that is discussed. But again, I think when I talk to my peers, whether it's recruiting on a sideline in the summer, I think face-offs is probably the number one thing people talk about. and goal mouth, crease play, dives is probably a close number two.
With respect to the specificity around being able to review hits to the head and neck area and what we saw this past year with respect to the implementation of the 2 and 3 minute non-releasable penalties, what was the thought there? What was the discussion like?
I think this is an important one as well. Certainly there's some changes with the helmets and things of that nature have fallen off, and we want to make sure guys are wearing their helmets properly. But when they instituted that new rule with head contact and the different degrees of penalties, that's another one that it's really hard for officials to get accurate. And I think, again, you look at other sports and kind of what they've installed. You look at football and targeting penalties. You know, if you're going to call that and eject somebody from a football game, you got to be confident that that's exactly what happened. And I think it's the same for a 2 or 3 minute penalty where, you know what, even if it was a 1 minute and you didn't think it was bad, maybe the instant replay shows it was worse than it was, or et cetera. So it's another way, a 2 or 3 minute penalty is such a significant time to be penalized that you want to make sure that it's the right call. And I think that's another area where officials maybe felt like it's hard to call an accurate call because it's so subjective, it happens so fast, and maybe they didn't get a perfect angle of it. We want to make sure, one, we're protecting players, but also, again, getting those calls right because it is such an important play where if you're going down for 3 minutes of a 15-minute quarter, it's significant.
One of the elements of this is the level of certainty, and we're releasing this podcast on the day in which the prop committee or the panel is going to determine whether or not to push these rules through. It could end up being that the proposal gets revised in some way that's currently unforeseen. But one of the other elements of that level of certainty is because it's an off year and because there are, I think my sense is the committee feels like you're pretty aggressive in your proposals, that if there were situations or unintended consequences that went the other way, and basically that you could kind of unwind a few of these types of things next year. And what I'm specifically referring to is, so you mentioned that, So let me take one step back. So a monitor at the scorer's table going to require the official to go to the monitor, set up the video, review it, make a determination, communicate the decision, and then restart play. My guess is that that's going to take about 3 minutes. So, you know, every review theoretically adds 3 minutes to the duration of a game. You said you would anticipate most challenges going unused. And that might be the case. But it could also be the case in a use it or lose it scenario where it's essentially treated like a third timeout. And if that is indeed the case, then some games could see 4 coaches' challenges used. And then my kind of cursory research suggests that there was about between 1 and 1.5, so let's just say 1.25, 2 and 3 minute non-releasable penalties giving per game. So in that scenario, if it were indeed the case that 5 challenges were utilized per game and it was 3 minutes long, then you're adding 15 minutes of duration to the game. That's a substantial change. And if that were to unfold, again, based on, you know, my sense for how the committee kind of approached the conversation, you could revisit it next year and say, all right, we're gonna pull back on this. We're okay with the idea of adding 8 minutes average duration to a game, but not okay with 15. Is that a fair characterization of how you guys are thinking about it?
A couple things there. We wouldn't have 3 timeouts. It'd still only be 2 because if you
no,
failed,
but I'm saying
you would lose the timeout. I don't think.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, got it.
Yeah, I think that. You know, again, I think like anything, there's sometimes unintended consequences, and what's important is we try to get it right. And I think that's why it's so nice to have different, you know, one of the guys that is a non-voting member is Willie Scroggs, and that guy's been in the game for so many decades that he's able to provide wisdom, and we just kind of get feedback from so many different people to really try to think through every scenario. And is it perfect? No.
Certainly and not. Perfect should not be the standard. It will never be perfect.
Correct. But I think we're doing our best to really try and get these right. And it's also important for viewers and listeners to know that, you know, it's not going to be a challenge of a head contact. It's scoring plays and adding that in. And I think, you know, maybe the rollout at first is a little not perfect, but I think, again, as we get more accustomed to it and more comfortable, a lot of these officials that have done PLL games or worked in the pros or even back in the MLL were doing this, so there is some familiarity there. And again, I think like anything, the better we get, the better it's going to be for the sport long term to make sure there's no incidents that happen like in the Final Four this year.
For sure, yeah. And I think that ultimately that is the important takeaway, is that creating a rule set that is permissive so that, you know, in the highest leverage moments, the integrity of the outcome is adhered to and is observed. And so, you know, from that standpoint, these are very positive. And I think that the other side of the coin, as you guys have discussed, is like, how do you utilize it in a way where it's available when it's needed, but also moderated in a way where it doesn't have the negative consequences that we've seen happen in other sports. And that's essentially the point that I would make, is that lacrosse, because of its stage development, has the opportunity to utilize the learnings from other sports. So let's utilize those learnings and avoid some of the pitfalls that have befallen, you know, football, basketball, baseball, soccer, whatever. So, but it's exciting and it's interesting and it's compelling. So we really appreciate your time joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Of course, Coach Papura, that'll do it. And we look forward to hearing the outcome of the playing rules oversight panel, and look forward to talking to you again at some point in the future.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Terry.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.